Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Don, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
Hi. Sober tonight by the living grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's what I believe Alcoholics Anonymous to be, is the modern-day miracle. And we'll go into that in a little while. But first of all, I suppose you've all heard of the new psychiatric hotline that's in some places, and it's answered by a recording. And it says, "Hello, welcome to the psychiatric hotline. If you're obsessive compulsive, please press 1 repeatedly. If you are codependent, please ask someone to press 2. If you have multiple personalities, please press 3, 4, 5, and 6. If you're paranoid delusional, we know who you are and what you want. Just stay on the line until we trace the call. If you're schizophrenic, listen carefully and a little voice will tell you which number to press. And if you're manic depressive, it doesn't matter which number you press, no one will answer." They normally should tell a story, and the only drinking story I can recall was when I was in the Air Force. In 1940, I enlisted in the Royal Canadian Air Force as a pilot and was shipped overseas to the desert in the Middle East. And one of the stories I heard there is they told me it's about a young playboy who met a young woman down in a bar one night in a hotel. And he invited her up to his room for a drink. Well, he got her up there, and she seemed to be quite intelligent and well done. So he asked her, "Would you care for a drop of port or sherry wine?" "Why, sherry, by all means," she replied, "because sherry to me is the nectar of all gods. Just looking at it here in its crystal clear decanter fills me with the anticipation of a heavenly thrill. And when the stopper's removed and the gorgeous liquid is poured into a glass, I inhale the delicious tangy fumes and I am lifted on the wings of ecstasy. It seems I taste its magic potion and my whole being seems to glow. 1,000 violins throb in my ears and I'm sent into another world." "On the other hand," she said, "port makes me fart." I'm sorry, that's the only drinking story I can recall. I can tell you a story about a local parish priest who one day visited the convent. And when he got to the convent, he was met by the Mother Superior, who was all wrought up and distressed. And he says, "Good heavens, what's the matter?" And she says, "Father, we have a terrible problem in the convent." And he asks, "Well, what's the problem?" She says, "Well, it's not a problem of spiritual nature, Father, so there's no sense going into it with you." "Well," he says, "you know, we priests get a lot of experience in many areas of life." He says, "Why don't you tell me what the problem is anyway?" "Well," she said, "the nuns bought a pet." And he said, "That's great." "No, Father," she said, "it's terrible. This pet they bought is a talking budgie bird. And all day long this little bird swings back and forth on its swing and says, 'Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute. Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute.' Now, the nuns and novices and postulants have tried everything to teach this bird to say something else, and she just won't do it, and we're beside ourselves." "Well," the good father said, "I told you it pays to talk about your problems, because, see, I too happen to be a bird lover, and I have 2 talking budgie birds, and my budgie birds are so intelligent, and they speak so well, that I had a rosary and a Bible made up in miniature, and all day long they pray and read the Bible." And Mother Superior said, "That is unbelievable." "Well," he said, "I'll take your bird down and expose your bird to my 2, and perhaps they'll be able to teach your bird to say something else." So Mother Superior ran and got the cage, gave it to good father. He got in his car and went down to the apartment, and he walked in. Sure enough, he looked up at the cage. There's Clyde and Clive standing in the bottom of the cage reading and the Bible and praying. So he popped the nun's bird in with this 2, and she got up in the top swing and swung back and forth and says, "Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute." And with that, Clyde turned to Clive. He said, "Clive, you can throw away the birds and book, the beads and book. Our prayers have just been answered. So. I came, when I see the age of some of these people, I wonder. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1948. I was 26 years of age, and I was living up in Northern Ontario in Canada. I was on a geographical cure to get away from all these people who drank so much. And I figured if I lived up in the boondocks, where people wouldn't drink so much, and it'd be easier for me to control it. And of course, I lived up there, and I wasn't doing too well because I kept on drinking. And what happened was one day we had a pastoral visit, and this pastor was talking, and when he left a parcel with us, and I opened it, and then it was a book and had a yellow and red and white cover on it, and it was entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. And I turned to my wife then and said, "Why do you think he left a book like that with me?" And she said, "Oh, he probably thinks you need it." And that did it. I threw that book in the corner. I swore I'd never read it as long as I lived. And I said, "Furthermore, if that bird ever sets foot inside this house again, I'll bodily pick him up and throw him out. Because all these ministers and priests are a bunch of racketeers anyway, who prey on the emotions of old women and young children. And this religion is a form of primitive superstition anyway, and anybody with any sense knows that. And I don't want to hear any more about it." And she says, "Donald, I'm a nurse." And she says, "We have people in the hospital who are not as bad as you get sometimes." And I said, "What do I have to do to prove to you I am not an alcoholic?" And she said, "Very simple. If you go on the wagon and don't take a drink for 1 year, I'll never bring it up again." And I said, "1 year? Fine, you're on." And so I decided I would go on the wagon. Now, this was in November. And so I went all through Christmas and New Year, and people come over and I'd pour them a drink, and you know, and they'd say, "Aren't you going to join me?" I'd say, "Can't." And they'd say, "Why not?" And I'd point the kitchen, I'd say, "Her." And I'd say, her mother started the temperance union, and she's just a chip off the old block, and they're not happy unless everybody else is miserable, but that's one of these things we men have to bear for the sake of the children, etc. So, you know, I'd say, very... That's horrible, but I think back on it now. But anyway, I was on the wagon. And then I went all through Christmas and New Year very sanctimoniously and self-righteously. And then it was January and went by. In February, I said to my wife one day, I said, "I won't be here this weekend. I'm going up to a northern town north of here, to Kirkland Lake." And she says, "Who's going?" And I told her, she says, "Well, I don't think you should go." And I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, those guys drink so much, and you've been doing so well, I don't think you should really go." And so that was challenging me, you know, throwing down the gauntlet. So I says, up to that point, I hadn't really cared whether I went or not. But the minute she says you shouldn't, I decided I was going, just to show her. So Saturday, the guys came over and picked me up, and we left town. There's four of us in the car, and one of them passed around a bottle of Sandy McDonald's Scotch whiskey. And it came to me, and I thought, well, you know, we're going to spend the night in Kirkland Lake. We won't be home until tomorrow, so I could take a drink, and she'd never know anything about it anyway. So I took a drink, and nothing happened. So I thought, oh, maybe that's the problem. Maybe I've been working too hard and was overtired or something. And so when the bottle came around again, I thought, well, I could have another one. And even if she did find out, it serves her right for not trusting me in the first place. Now, if you can understand that, that's called drunk logic. And so I had another one. Of course, I never did get to the meeting. Two of us stayed drinking all night. Two went to the meeting, and then it was Sunday morning. And we got back home, and I came into the house and, of course, embarrassed my wife and children one more time. And then it was Monday morning. And this morning was different to any other. There was no more finger wagging or head shaking or anything else. She was in the kitchen and was totally incommunicado. I got up and tried to make conversation with her, and it wasn't working. If I came to this side, she just turned her back and just did this all along, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Because she wouldn't talk to me. I didn't realize that that morning she had decided that she was in a hopeless marriage and was going to take the children and leave. But I didn't know that at the time, and I thought, but I'm in real trouble, and I knew that. And I used to tell her, you know, I had a sixth sense. And she says, Donald, I'm so glad you do, because you obviously lack the other five. And I used to think, well, I knew I'm in trouble. And we lived above this little grocery store we operated. And so I started down the stairs figuring, boy, she's really upset this time, and I'll have to think of something. And as I got downstairs, I went to open the door, and who comes walking across the street but Hal Fleming. Now, Hal Fleming was a drinking buddy of mine. And on New Year's Day that year, he'd been taken to the local hospital with the DTs. And while he was there, a pastor visited him and asked him what he was doing. And Hal said, well, he's an alcoholic. And the pastor said, why don't you stop drinking? And Hal said, I've tried, but I can't. And the pastor says, well, I know a member of, I've heard of him, of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll ask him to come and see you, which he did. And this AA member went to see Hal. And Hal got out of that hospital bed and never took another drink again until he died some 25 years later. But AA was very different in those days. It's not like it is now. And so the first thing they told him to do, he said to them, what do I have to do to stay sober? They says, go and find another drunk. He says, oh, I know one, Nicholson, down the grocery store in town. So down he comes. And he comes in to see me, and he's telling what a wonderful deal this is, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm thinking, well, I'm glad you did that, Hal. You're getting pretty bad anyway, you know. So you... And, of course, I should have known because I was with him all the time. But he had been coming in periodically just checking to see if I was in the right mood or not. But this morning I was chewing dentine gum. And the only time I ever chewed gum, he knew it, was the morning after. So the customers wouldn't smell my breath when I was at the front register. So Hal comes walking across the street with a big smile on his face, and I thought, uh-oh, you know, now this Hal, this is really trouble. And so I started to make some excuses, and he wanted to talk to me about this thing that he had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got this great idea. I thought, now, if I told her I was going to go with him to a meeting, I'll bet you she'd talk back to me and we'd get her over this. And so I said to him, I said, Hal, how much does this thing cost? And he said, it's free. I said, what do you do? He says, we just meet and talk about alcoholism. And I said, that's all there's to it. What's the catch? He said, there's no catch. It's free. And he said, and so I said, you know, Hal, I got this great idea then. I said, you know, Hal, I've got a brother who drinks quite a bit. Do you think I could go to one of those meetings with you and find out something about this and perhaps help my brother? Hal says, sure, we can have guests at the meeting. You can be my guest. So I thought, this is it. So I said, wait right here. And he was at the foot of the stairs, and I shot up the back stairs in the kitchen. She was still there with his back to me, and I says, Hal Fleming's downstairs. Nothing. And I said, I'm going to one of those A&A meetings with him on Friday night. That did it. She turned around and threw arms around me and says, oh, Donald, I'm so glad to hear you're finally going to do something about your drinking. I thought, nice going, I got her now. So I said, will you go to the bank for me today and talk to the banker? And she said, yes, what should I tell him? So I told her what to say. I started going down the back stairs again to see Hal, and I said, can you imagine, 30 minutes ago, three major crises in my life. Her, the banker, and this drinking thing. And so she wouldn't talk to me, so I thought, this isn't bad. So I said to Hal, you'll have to leave now, Hal, but I'll meet you on Friday. Well, I'll go to the meeting with you on Friday. And he said, all right. So he left. And she went to the bank for me. And, of course, I stayed sober Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I closed the store a little early because I thought he'd forgotten to come. And went upstairs. And no sooner upstairs than the phone rang. It's Hal Fleming on the phone. She's standing right beside me. She had ears like radar. She could hear anything. She could hear lips moving. And I'm starting to make my excuses to Hal why this was not a good night for me to be going, and I'd go some other time with him, but I had a lot of things to do. I had an inventory to take and so on and so forth at the store. And with that, she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "You promised, and I don't mind you breaking your word with me and the children, but at least you should keep your word with other people." So I said, "Okay, Hal, where is this meeting?" He said, "It's over in Haileybury, the next town." It was 5 miles away. And I says, "When? What time is it?" He says, 8:30. I says, "Good, we can go up in one bus and back in the next," because the buses ran every hour. And he says, "We don't have to go on the bus. One of the fellows is here, one of the members with his car. We'll come over and pick you up." And I says, "Don't you dare come over here. I could just see that big white station wagon with Alcoholics Anonymous written on the side of it. And there'd be a loudspeaker on the roof, you know, blaring music, and there'd be these characters with bald heads and pigtails and robes and flowers and handing out pamphlets and flowers saying how they've been saved. And I didn't want any of that religious crap, you know. So I said, "Don't you dare come over here, because what would the neighbors think if they saw that car at my door?" So I said, "I'll meet you over at your place." So I get ready to go, and I get out the back door and down the back alley, because I was scared if I met somebody, they'd say, "Where are you going? What are you going to say? You can't say you're going to go to the A&A meeting, because they'd think there's something wrong with you if you did that." So I went down to Hal's place, and I got in, and here was this guy dressed with a suit and tie, and I got a hold of Hal, and I said, "Who's that?" He says, "Oh, it's a court clerk from Haileybury." I said, "The courts are behind this thing." Hal says, no. He says, "He's a member." And I said, "Well, he doesn't look like an alcoholic to me." "Well," he says, "he is." So we got in the car and we drove up to Haileybury. And we went to Terry Smith's house. He is manager of the lumber company. I thought, "Oh, God." Now, Terry must be the guy who's bankrolling these birds, because he had a pretty good job, you know. And I knew he didn't drink, because I'd heard he hadn't been drinking. So we got in and they started. And each one in turn started telling me what it used to be like, what happened, and what it was like now. And as they were talking, it suddenly dawned on me, I'm wise to this. What these birds do, they phone your wife, she tells them all about you, then they say they did these things, and that's how they suck people into this deal. And boy, wait till I get home, I'll straighten her out, because some of those things are pretty personal. And finally, I blurted it out. I said, "How come you guys, what are you guys talking about?" And they said, it's just a projection of the basic symptoms of alcoholism. And I said, "Well, I've done all those things, and I'm not an alcoholic." That was like waving a red flag at a bull, you know. We got a live one tonight. So they started in. And in AA in those days, the meeting always lasted as long as it took to convince that newcomer to come back to the next meeting. I was there at 8:30 sharp, and I didn't get home till 2:30 in the morning. But I said I'd come back. So I started coming back on a regular basis. I got rolling along in this thing. As time went on, I began to realize, when we find out more about the symptoms of alcoholism, you can go back in the history books and pick out the drunks. And my favorite, of course, was Christopher Columbus. And I know that Christopher Columbus had to be an alcoholic. Just read his story. When he left home, he had no idea where he was going. When he got to America, he didn't know where he was. When he got back home, he didn't know where he'd been. And to top it off, some woman paid for the whole shot. I don't know about anybody else, but that sounds remarkably like my drinking story. Oh, and of course, the drinking, of course, I don't know. We blamed the war for a lot of things, because what happened when I was in the desert, in the Desert Air Force, and we had the pilots' club mess, and we had lots of booze, and what happened is we used to charge our drinks, and the bartender would put them in a little book, and payday would have to pay them. So after the first couple of bombing missions we ran on, though, we got a couple of aircraft shot down, and then here's these two guys, they owed a bar bill. And so we had to have a meeting, and he said what to do about this, because he didn't want them to send the bar bill home to parents of a pilot who had just been shot down in the desert. So we decided what we'd have to do then on payday. Everybody had to put so much money into the bank account in the bar. And it was a debit account, you know. So we did that. And then we had an agreement amongst all the pilots. We agreed that what we'd do is if any one of us got shot down, then that night everybody could have a party by drinking up the rest of our bar bill till it was zeroed out. That was great, but it was every other night we were having a party, and we were drinking all the time. But you know, when you think of it, and as I say, it takes quite a while. And the longer I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, it took a long time to seep in just what my problem was. And I realized one time when I got the Parade magazine, which is part of the Saturday paper, and in it was a little deal, and it was they're talking about some of the mental health terms that are commonly misused by these psychiatrists and doctors. And I started reading through this thing, and I couldn't believe it. They had such things like anxiety and fear. Anxiety is when you're paralyzed with fright, but you don't know what you're afraid of. Many emotional disturbances begin with anxiety. Fear, on the other hand, is the dread of some specific thing. Well, of course, I had tremendous fears. And one of my fears was a fear of failure. And I always thought, what would happen, you know, if people found out that I failed, what would they think of me? And so I was so afraid of failure, I'd be immobilized sometime. And then I realized that's nonsense, because after I'd been around in AA for a little while and sobered up, I began to realize a lot of these things were foolishness. You don't have to worry about failure, because if you fail in life, nobody pays any attention. If you want to be noticed in life, be successful. And for instance, we can go back a few years ago when the, I'm sure you've all heard of the Titanic. Have you all heard of the Titanic? You know? Brand new ship, left England on its way to America, and 1,500 passengers on board, and the ship, the captain of that ship made an error in navigation, and the ship struck an iceberg and sank, and those 1,500 lives were lost. Now, the name of the ship is the Titanic, you all know that. Those of you who remember the name of the captain that was guilty of the most colossal human failure of the era, what was the name of the captain of the Titanic? Raise your hand, those who know. One, two, three, four people. His name was John Smith. We can always remember the incident, but very few can remember his name because he was a failure. On the other hand, let's talk about success. And this was the first flight across the Atlantic Ocean, a solo flight, from New York to Paris. Now that ship was an airship, it was an airplane. And it was called the Spirit of St. Louis. Has anybody heard of the Spirit of St. Louis? Raise a hand. Oh, you've heard of that. Okay. Now, the captain of that ship was a success. Do any of you happen to remember the name of the success? Charles Lindbergh. You can remember a difficult name like Lindbergh because he was successful. But the failure, John Smith, you can't remember his name. I've never been afraid of failure from that day to this, because I know if I fail, nobody will pay any attention. And so that's a nice thing to find out. This other thing is called psychosis. That was another one of my problems. This disorder is characterized by defective or lost contact with reality. Psychotics often see things and hear voices. And I can recall how many times I would sit over in the bar and the smoke curling up and I'm drinking. And I figured it all out that my problem, the only problem I had, was I was always broke. If I could just win the Irish sweepstakes, and in those days that was the only gambling there was, and I think first prize was $40,000 or something, because we're talking a long time ago. And what I could do is I could build a house over in the hill and it would look like a state capitol. And I could put her and the two kids there and have a maid for them and a chauffeur and a car. Then I could go over to the Riviera and be a playboy. And all the neighbors and friends would say, isn't he a wonderful father? Look what he's done for that family. I didn't even have a ticket in the Irish sweepstakes. But I spent that first prize many times. So that tells me not only was I anxious and fearful, I was also psychotic, mentally ill. Neurosis. This emotional disorder is caused by a conflict of which the person is unaware. For example, you want sex, but also want to please your mother, who said sex was bad. And this unconscious conflict produces a neurosis that could affect your sex life. Well, you know, it's a strange thing that I, as an alcoholic, cannot remember the first Coca-Cola or orange juice or tea or coffee I ever had. But my first drink of alcohol is still very fresh in my mind. I've never forgotten my first drink of alcohol. And what it was on a Sunday afternoon. There's four fellows. We were over at a girl's house on Sunday afternoon. Her folks were out, and we were talking, and she had a girlfriend there, and she opened the cupboard door, and we spotted a bottle up there, and we said, "What's that?" She said, "It's Daddy's gin. Would you boys like a drink?" Well, we all sort of nudged each other. You know, none of us ever had a drink. We said, "Well, sure, you know, we'll have a drink." So she put four glasses down and put four straight shots. Well, Jack, he picked his up, smelled it, and he put it down. He said, "Oh, my gosh," he said, "I couldn't drink that. It smells terrible." And Jerry, he smelled it, took a mouthful. He said, "Oh," he said, "that burns." David, he took it, swallowed it down in one gulp, and he made a horrible face. Right there and then, I decided I would take that drink and not make a face, just to prove to these two girls there's one man in this outfit. So I took it and bottoms up, and down it went. And it hit bottom, and all of a sudden it started to come back, and I thought, "My God, I poisoned myself." But all of a sudden I got this nice warm glow, came all through me, and I suddenly seemed to grow 6 inches taller. And I looked at these two flat-chested little girls, and they suddenly looked voluptuous to me. Then I entered into the illusion that I looked great to them. And for the first time in my life, I could talk to girls. Now, you know, let me talk about our sex life. I can remember my first drink, but if you said, "Don, do you remember your first sexual experience?" I'd say, "No, I'm very vague. The only thing I can recall today, I was all alone at the time." But, you know, so that's... This is... That also caused me... Not only was I neurotic, but I was also paranoid. Alcoholics are egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. That's what I've discovered. And that's strange. It's a conflict of terms, and anybody will tell you that, but every alcoholic knows, yeah, that's right. We know what you mean. We also had a manic depressive syndrome. And this condition is marked by mood swings of uncontrollable elation and activity. Hence the term manic and withdrawal and depression. My emotions were either over or under amplified at all time. Never had a straight level. It was always up or down like that. And so that told me that I had a manic depressive syndrome all the time. So that's another part of this mental illness. And then the other one, the great one that really got me, was schizophrenia. And this group of disorders can cause delusions, hallucinations, and aggressive and antisocial behavior. Well, I used to have a great deal of delusions and hallucinations. I was insanely jealous of my wife, and I one time told her I had a sixth sense, you know, that about things, and she said, "You know, that's great, because you obviously lack the other five. I mentioned that earlier, but this caused me a schizophrenic as well." So those are the problems I had when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had one other problem. During the war, so much had happened that I didn't believe anything about religion or anything else. And I was an agnostic, and I had problems when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous talking about this higher power. And what I would do, I would say, "You know, if there was a God, he would know that there's all kinds of people like me, and he'd perform a miracle that I could witness with my own eyes. But you notice where all the miracles are? You read about them in Reader's Digest. France, Italy, Yugoslavia, never where they speak English. So I always figured that if this God was half smart, he'd perform a miracle that I could witness with my own eyes. And of course, no miracle, no God. It was that simple. But one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, if we just keep coming to meetings and not drinking, and you must come on a regular, consistent basis. And I discovered very early in my AA career that alcoholism was very similar to another condition I was familiar with at the time I came to AA, and that's a condition known as body odor. Now, the reason I say that alcoholism is like body odor, there is no known cure in the world today for either body odor or for alcoholism. However, there is successful treatment for both conditions. Now, if it's body odor, you must bathe consistently on a regular basis. I can't decide to go for 2 or 3 weeks and live in my car and not start to smell bad. And it's the same thing as I can't go to 2 or 3 meetings in a row of Alcoholics Anonymous and then skip them for a few weeks, because that has put me right back to where I came in the first day I went to AA. It must be, AA must be attended on a regular, consistent basis. And those are when the amazing things happen to us. That's when we find out a lot about the disease and the recovery, and also begin to witness the miracles that are available every day in every way. And some of these miracles were just unbelievable. And I couldn't understand how I was so dumb and didn't miss so many of them. I think of one of the things that really got me was when you think of the Boeing 747. Some 35 years ago, the aeronautical engineers studied the geese. And the reason they did that is the goose is the heaviest bird that flies. And what they didn't understand is why it was that geese always flew in a formation, one goose leading and the others coming in behind. And so they discovered that what happened was when the lead goose flapped his wings up and down, he disturbed the air, or the aeronautical term for it is burbled the air. And the other geese flew along and burbled air, and it requires 25% less energy to remain airborne and burbled air than it does smooth air. And with that in mind, the aeronautical engineers designed the Boeing 747. And you'll notice they all have little wingtips set up like that. They look like a goose when they're in the air, the long neck and the wings way behind, and they've all got winglets. And they require 25% less energy. And then when you're talking about airplanes, that means fuel. So when you see in the movies or on TV that Boeing 747 going down the runway in Chicago or Minneapolis or wherever, and the nose lifts off the ground, at that point, that airplane is traveling at 165 miles per hour. And it takes off and climbs at almost a 45 degree angle. It has 60,000 gallons of fuel on board. That's enough to fill 2 swimming pools, neighborhood swimming pools. And it burns off 6,000 gallons just in the climb to altitude. And so the Boeing 747 was a result of the aeronautical engineers studying the geese. So I could say, I could say, well, the geese, they unstudied the geese, they knew they did this. But my question was, who taught the geese to do that? How did they find out? Somebody must have let them know. Another thing is, talking about birds, there's small birds, the swallows. Every year in Capistrano, the swallows used to flock together on a certain date and fly off. Nobody knew where they went. And then on a certain date the next year, they came back. Nobody knew where they went till one day some ornithologists were on the southern coast of California when these swallows came down and they landed, and they all walked around on the ground until they found a little twig that they picked up in their feet and took off. And they went out over the water, and when they got tired, they would drop the little twig and bob up and down on it, take a rest, close their feet on the little twig, and carry on. Now, they taught the ornithologists how to get from California to Buenos Aires in Argentina. But my question is, who taught the birds that? So that has to be another one of these miracles that happened. Another one of these times, I was reading in the newspaper an article written by the president of the New York Academy of Science. And he was a geneticist. And he was talking about why men of science believe in God. And he was talking about our genes. He said, you know, it's an amazing thing, the genes, all human behavior stems from our genes. But he said, these genes are so small and so tiny, if you took all the genes from the people in the world today, they would only fill a cup. Now that is something amazing. That has to also be a miracle. The other thing I think of is our fingerprints. You know, there's never been two sets of fingerprints. I mean, my name is Donald, but then that's because my parents, they're humans, and that's what they named me. But I am known to the higher power, who is responsible for my creation anyway. And when you stop and think, there's no two sets of fingerprints in the world has ever been the same. There's each one of us have 10 prints. There's what, 275 or almost 300,000, 275 million, almost 300 million Americans. And there's no two sets of fingerprints the same. And when you go around and look at the population of the world, there's over 5 billion, 50 billion, and there's no two sets of fingerprints the same. How do you explain that? That has to be a miracle. And so therefore, I was privileged by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, learning to look in the right places for the right at the right time, discovered there's many, many miracles every day in every way. One of my favorite miracles of all, of course, is when I think of when you take a tiny brown seed, and all you have to do is just poke it down. You can put it in a plastic cup if you wish, but just poke it down in some black soil. Give it some moisture and some light. And the next thing we know, we get a dark green plant out of that black soil from that tiny brown seed. And when the plant has matured enough, you can pull that green plant out of the ground and it has a bright red root. And you say, how can you have a bright red root on a dark green plant out of black soil from a tiny brown seed? Until you cut the root in half and it has a pure white heart. And my question is, how can you have a pure white heart in a bright red root from a dark green plant out of black soil from a tiny brown seed? So every day when I go by the salad bar and I see that radish, I always acknowledge that God is alive and well today and still performing miracles for dummies like me to prove that he is his existence. The other thing I discovered about this higher power, how wise he is. And I hear people say, well, you know, God rewarded me today. I got a promotion at work. I got a raise in pay. And then on the other hand, they'd say, well, you know, God punished me today. I got fired. God does not reward or punish us on a daily basis. God is the power. It's like the power for the lights in this room. If the light switch was over there and I walked over there and flicked the switch and the lights went out, would somebody say, oh, the power has failed? They say, no, that moron just shut them off. And so I just flick them back up and say, ha, see? Light and dark, light and dark, light and dark. The power is here all the time. But I manipulate it, the up and down. And I discovered that's the way things work in life. Because God does not reward or punish us on a daily basis. Because there's far too many of us running loose on planet Earth. And he's a very busy guy. And so what he did when we were born, he said, I am also giving you, each and every one of you, a free will. That simply means whatever you will, I will provide the power. So if you will it, to be happy, joyous, and free, if Patch, and he said, my boy, you can stay that way as long as you choose. You take the action, I'll provide the power. But if you want to feel miserable, depressed, and anything else, you take that action and you can stay depressed until you become suicidal. But that's your choice, not mine. I just provide the power. I'm the power just like for the lights in this room. But we control the switch on and off, on and off. And so it is, I discovered that's the way things work in life. So many of us think when we come to AA that we have a drinking problem. And of course, that was my problem also. I thought I had a drinking problem. And really, that's not the case at all. Because I can recall back in the early days, for instance, when Bill started off with this, and incidentally, I was very, very fortunate in AA, because in 1952 I went back into the Air Force because I had I was $13,000 in debt, and the only way I could pay this off was if I went back in the Air Force flying, which I went back into the Air Force for, and it took me 13 years and 3 months to pay off that $13,000. But that was fine. I was able to do that. And while I did that, I was back in 1952, and in 1953 I was called into headquarters and told I was one of the pilots was to go to Bridgeport, Connecticut to pick up the new helicopters to build the Mid-Canada line with. So I went down to Bridgeport and they'd take one and fly it up to the base in Canada and then come back for the next one, and they'd tell me, well, we had a glitch in the line, it won't be ready till tomorrow, why don't you just run into town? And they meant New York. So I take the train in, and it's about a 45-minute run into New York. And I didn't have any money or able to do much, so I just went up to the office, the AA office. And I go in and sit and talk to Bill. No, I shouldn't say I talked to Bill. I'd go in and listen to Bill. And I was very fortunate. He'd be sitting there with his hand behind his head and his feet up in the desk all the time. There's just two or three girls working in the office. I think one was paid and the other two were volunteers. And I could listen to him for hours. And then I'd take the next day, I'd go back and take an airplane up, and maybe the next two I would every so often, though, they'd skip one that was a glitch in the line, so I'd go back and talk to Bill. And so I was very fortunate that I had that opportunity to meet Bill and Lois in the early days and go out to their home and everything else, and it was just a wonderful thing. We also, at that time, we had a chairman of the General Service Board, and his name was Bernard B. Smith, an attorney, and he put all this AA stuff together for Bill. And one day Bern Smith was in New York, and he was at a law meeting in a large audience. They had some sort of a course on for attorneys, and he was up on the podium, and they wanted to know, were there any questions? And so one of them, knowing about Bern Smith's involvement with Alcoholics Anonymous, asked him from the floor, they said, what is AA's true message to the world? Because they knew Bern Smith was chairman of the board. And Bernard Smith said, AA's true message to the world is not that they have succeeded in ceasing to drink, but in so ceasing to drink, they have succeeded in learning to live. And that's the thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't just here come to quit drinking. We come here and learn how to live. And you know, when you think of it, I spent so much time being an agnostic or an atheist and whatever. Well, not an atheist, because atheists don't have holidays. I was just an agnostic. And I used to think, you know, woe is me. Every payday I had to make that thing for 13 years and 3 months to pay off that drinking debt. And, oh, poor me, I'm never going to have anything, all that stuff. And about 100 years ago, there was something scribbled by an anonymous soldier of the Confederacy. And I read this thing, and I couldn't believe it. I took it into my wife, and I said, look at this. How can this happen? This guy, 100 years ago, is describing what has happened to me in my life today. And it goes something like this. I asked God for strength that I might achieve, but I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. Instead, I've been given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything I had hoped for. So despite myself, my prayers were answered, and I feel I am among all men most richly blessed. And the only message I can leave with this wonderful crowd tonight is may God bless each and every one of you in the same manner. And thank you so much for having me down here this weekend.